You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 10th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, first half will be an archived interview with Alfie Cohn, educator from the interview, I think, is from late 2011. We've got a fire alarm situation in the building today, folks. We will be live after the interview, going into the funner half of the program, wherein we will talk about the latest report to show the Republican problems with the Ute of today. Meanwhile, Edward Snowden testifies to the EU. John Kirikou, the CIA analyst who is in federal prison right now, serving a 30-month term, writes an editorial for the Washington Post, which will probably land him in solitary, is my understanding, about the rank hypocrisy of his prosecution. Also on the program today, more news around the edges of Obamacare. Maybe a little bit from CPAC. I don't know. I'm sort of over it. All that and more, your phone calls, your IMs. Let me just start, and I guess we'll briefly, just tell you the story of this Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. It is, as of now, it's not a political story, sort of fascinating. A Boeing 777, Malaysian Airlines, took off from Kuala Lumpur on Saturday, 1 a.m., which would have been, Friday afternoon here, Eastern Time. It had about 230 passengers and maybe about a dozen crew members. It has just disappeared. There's no reports of an explosion, no reports of a mayday, no reports of anything found in the ocean. It just seems to have vanished without a trace. They are expanding the rescue zone, but it's been 4 days now, and they still have found absolutely nothing. There is some vague suspicion about two passengers who were traveling on stolen passports, but from what I've read, that's not necessarily something that's terribly, terribly unique. So nobody knows. Just a strange story. I also wanted to point out, I guess it was last Thursday, in an interview, Bernie Sanders told John Nichols he's prepared to run for the president of the United States. It's not a formal announcement, but definitely a good thing. I mean, I've seen now polls that say somewhere between 80 and 87% of Democrats want Hillary Clinton to run. I don't know if that translates into support. And of course, we're, you know, 2 years out. But the idea of a primary, even if it's one simply to get the to have arguments and to have issues raised, I think is an important one. And I think primaries is the one area where we really, as progressives, whether, you know, whether or not you identify as a Democrat or not, I mean, if you perceive the Democratic Party as the best of the best opportunity to carry a progressive message, at least, or I should say, progressive governance. There may be other parties that provide for a better message, but for actual governance, the Democratic Party is what we got. Primaries are woefully underused by progressives, and there's a new site that has launched. It's new to me, anyways. PrimaryColors.net. It's a cool site that actually rates Democrats on whether or not or how forcefully the case can be made to primary them based upon a bunch of factors, their voting record and the nature of the district in which they're running. So we'll put a link to that at majority.fm, primarycolors.net. There's a big fight in this state and frankly across the country on the use and really the overuse of charter schools. Particularly in this state right now, Mayor de Blasio has really, I mean, it's not even a wholesale change. He has tweaked and rejected maybe, I don't know what percentage it would be, 5%, 10%, 20% or something like that, of the requests for charters to co-locate. What happens with charters, particularly in New York City, is the charters will form. They are not regulated in the same way by the city, in this case. They don't have teachers' unions. They don't have the same requirements, or they don't fulfill the same requirements, we should say, for teaching kids with special needs. They are self-selecting in terms of the students they let in there. And some charter schools do very well. On the whole, charters do not outperform public schools. Some instances, they woefully underperform. They also are rife with scams, frankly, and double dealing. And so what happens is they come in and they suck off the public schools' resources. When they co-locate, they necessarily push a public school out of the building or limited its capacity to provide services. And so the mayor has taken very moderate steps to moderate how much this gets approved. He approved 36 out of 45 applications for co-locations, just to give you a sense. But these charters are backed by hedge funds and huge money, corporate money. And so you hear about it as if it's bloody murder. And I just wanted to mention that in the context. I thought this Alfie Cohn interview was I've always found interesting, and he's the author of a couple of books. You can check him out at alfiecohn.org. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with that interview, and then we will take your phone calls, IMs, and talk more stories in the funner half. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be with talking to Alfie Cohn from 2011. Okay, on the phone, I'm talking to Alfie Cohn. He is an author of, well, I guess now 12 books, the most recent being Feel Bad Education, which just came out a couple of weeks ago. And you can check him out online at alfiecohn.org. We'll put a link up on majority.fm site. Welcome to the program, Alfie.
Thank you.
So, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of talk about teachers in terms of the union battles that's been going on. We've seen in the past year a rash of documentaries extolling the virtues of charter schools and vilifying teacher unions, and mm-hmm. we're now in the midst of a sort of a second round of a so-called education reform that deals with measuring the success of schools. First it was Leave No Child Left Behind, and now it's Race to the Top, I think they're calling it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see is the fundamental problem with education in this country today?
Poverty. If I had to say what the single cause is of problems, I have plenty of problems with traditional teaching that goes on in classrooms. But the policy suggestions, and not just suggestions, but mandates offered by both political parties, not only do nothing to address the central problems, either poverty on the one hand, or dreary traditional approaches to teaching that treat children like empty receptacles into which facts are poured on the other. What school reform, in quotes, tends to do is make the problem much, much worse, because it offers a corporate-styled, test-driven, heavy-handed, top-down approach that is squeezing the intellectual life out of schools and driving some of the best teachers away from classrooms.
Well, tell me, what's the problem with standardized testing? I mean, where are the what are the shortfalls of that aspect of because it seems like all of our discussion about the success of our schools and the means in which we are trying to incentivize schools to improve are all focused on this notion of testing.
Yes, and we can speak separately about incentivizing, even if that were a word in English. The problem is that it's based on a behaviorist notion of using carrots and sticks to manipulate people to do what you want. That's bad enough. The problem is that those incentives are not being used to improve the quality of learning. They're being used to drive up test scores. Standardized tests, first of all, tend to tell you mostly about the size of the houses near a given school. They are a reflection of affluence or its absence. You tell me how many kids at a given school are on free or reduced lunch and how much education their parents had, and I'll predict their test scores with chilling accuracy. But second, even if you controlled for the demographics, even if you set aside those issues and just looked at one school where the same population of kids were there year to year, these kind of tests tend to measure what matters least, so that plenty of really smart kids who understand questions and are deeply curious just don't do well on standardized tests. And conversely, some kids who may not be all that thoughtful are very good at taking tests. So they manage to overestimate and underestimate simultaneously. That means that people who really understand learning, which includes no one, virtually no one who's a politician making educational policy, and none of the hedge fund managers, and not Oprah and the documentarians and the people at NBC News or the LA Times or Bill Gates, none of them have a sense of what it means to have a rich, engaging classroom environment and an authentic way of assessing the quality of teaching and learning. And there's many, many ways to do that. The less you know about education, the more likely you are to rely on test scores to tell you when schools are doing well. The people who are in the field tend to ignore them, and yet the policymakers are talking about achievement levels and raising the bar and higher expectations and demanding excellence, and all they mean by these phrases are the scores on these terrible tests.
And so what are the means in which to authentically measure the quality of the education that's being delivered? I mean that, I guess, is the first challenge that before you could develop any type of broader policy.
Well, yes and no. To take the last part first, I don't think we would want assessment to be the tail wagging the dog. What you do is you create an education approach that is consistent with the best theory, practice, and research. You don't let that which lends itself to measurement drive what you do, particularly since measuring and assessing are not necessarily the same things. In other words, as Albert Einstein put it, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. To say that you don't want to reduce things unnecessarily to numbers doesn't mean that you can't assess the quality of learning. And there are ways to walk into a classroom, even without interacting with the kids, much less when you do, and really get a sense of whether this is a place that's about putting kids at the center and challenging them in a useful way to become more excited about what they learn and to be more proficient at playing with letters and numbers and words and ideas. But even if you do insist on numbers, there are ways of getting those numbers from the real projects and assignments that kids are doing in class over time, as opposed to one stress-filled week when kids have to take multiple choice tests that were devised by authorities far removed from where the learning takes place, which is what we're doing now.
I mean, I guess one of the biggest sort of hurdles to actually providing a good education across the income spectrums, aside from once we establish and start with the premise that that income is largely determinant, is the idea that education becomes so politicized that it's impossible. In some ways, it seems impossible to speak about education in the context of politics.
Well, it makes for some curious bedfellows, that's for sure. I mean, you've basically got the Obama administration intensifying the worst of what the Bush administration did. There are very few differences between Democrats and Republicans on this issue. The Republicans are pushing a little bit harder for privatization, for vouchers to basically throw democratic public education to the marketplace where profit drives what our children learn. But even that distinction is becoming blurred now, as Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, and who's basically being driven by the Gates Foundation and other billionaires, are more and more moving toward a privatized notion. So even that distinction, but everything else, with the talk of tests and national standards so that every fourth grader in the country is being taught according to the same benchmarks and expectations, all of this now means that the relevant distinction isn't between Democrats and Republicans anymore, even liberals and conservatives on other issues. The relevant distinction is between people who have a feel for how children learn, some knowledge of that, and people who haven't a clue. Unfortunately, the people who haven't a clue are mandating their ignorance on the rest of us with the force of law. And our children's schools are being turned into glorified test prep centers. And the more you require standardized tests to be passed before you can move on to the next grade or get a diploma, the more we're driving kids, not just the best teachers, out of school. All of this would be outrageous. And I think historians will look back on this period as one of the darkest periods in the history of American education. But what makes it worse is that everything I've been talking about in terms of this awful testing mania, this accountability fad, this corporate-style approach to school reform, does most of its damage on low-income kids of color. So when the people who talk about school reform claiming they're raising the bar and doing this for excellence and competitive global economy of the 21st century, that ought to put anyone off that it's all about economics. That's bad enough. But if they dare to justify this awful agenda in the name of equity, that becomes obscene. Because somehow the affluent white kids in the suburbs will manage to survive this standards and testing folly. But kids in the inner city are getting the kind of stuff that would turn anyone off to learning, and in many cases are being denied a diploma on the basis of a test score.
So, I mean, the problem is that the pre-existing support functions for education amongst the affluent is simply the absence of that leaves these kids, leaves poor kids and less affluent kids basically just as that much more vulnerable to the implications of these type of standardization.
Yes, because in the name of school reform or accountability or No Child Left Behind and all of the other propaganda that's offered to justify this, the slogans, what you've got is in much more intense pressure to do nothing but show better test scores for kids in the inner city. And the response is to gut the schools of anything resembling real learning. Out goes recess for the little kids. Out goes arts and music, mm-hmm. field trips, class discussions. Out goes reading real books of the kid's own choice, project-based learning, cooperative learning, interdisciplinary learning. And they're mostly being drilled to get better at taking these awful tests, mostly in English and math. Some of the real rich kinds of learning are maintained. They manage to survive in more affluent communities. So this is a way of actually, even if the test scores go up, you know, in Baltimore or Houston and Oakland or Chicago or New York, that's probably a bad sign.
Right.
And every parent needs to know that if the test scores go up in any school or district, the first response ought to be, oh no, what did you have to sacrifice from our children's education to make that happen? And the second response should be, you know what, my kid will not be there when you give the tests. And more parents are realizing that they need to start a grassroots movement against this corporate-style school reform and refuse to participate in this testing, which is more destructive because of the preparation for it that displaces real learning than it is just because of the time when the kids actually take the tests.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, you say that the we have this dilemma where people who understand what how to genuinely educate children are being mandated to do other things by people who don't. And,
right.
You know, from a political perspective, one of the things that scares me, I guess, or alarms me, I should say, is that the vast majority of people don't really know.
No,
and I would include myself in that. I mean, I have a 5.5-year-old daughter, and you know, we're completely befuddled as to how to even go about assessing for our own purposes
right.
whether or not she is being properly educated.
Right. That's a very good point. And I want to point out that a lot of progressives, people who are really on the left on political issues, are often found aligning with these corporate folks, basically with George W. Bush types when it comes to education, not because they're stupid or uncaring, but because most people have not been invited to think about this field. We think we know a little about education, more than we know about law or architecture.
Well, we've all been to school.
To school. That makes us, yeah, experts, exactly, well, which is not the case. So I've done a lot of my writing. I've written a lot of my books and articles specifically to try to invite parents and other people who are not professional educators to think about what it is we're looking for. What are our long-term goals? And then to say, for example, did you know that there is no research proving any benefit to making kids do homework of any kind before they're in high school? And it's pretty dubious even in high school. Did you know that the best schools don't give grades? And the more you push your kids to do better, even in high school, to improve their grades, the more superficial their thinking tends to become and the more they lose interest in learning. Did you know that the best teachers don't give tests? I mean, even tests of their own devising, not standardized tests, because they know that that information is not useful at assessing thinking, only memorizing stuff that they're going to forget soon anyway. Did you know that the best schools have kids of different ages learning in the same classroom together, where the kids have a lot to say about the curriculum? In other words, the best kind of teaching doesn't look like the classrooms most of us have experienced. And so we have to then develop other criteria for thinking about what makes classrooms successful. Now, the people who know a lot about this have been very carefully and systematically excluded from the conversation, and in fact discredited, so that, for example, you have people who write and research and think about this stuff for a living. They're excluded because, well, you know, they're educationists and pointy-headed, ivy-covered walls, you know, experts. They don't really know. That's part of the anti-intellectualism of our culture. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the actual teachers. And there is some variation in their views, of course, but most teachers are closer to what I've been describing than to what the Bush or Obama administrations are doing. And so there, what's been done is to discredit teachers through their unions, which dovetails nicely with the folks who bash any union for any reason and try to prevent workers from organizing. So what you hear is a lot of anti-union stuff. If it weren't for them getting in the way of bold school reform, our schools would be improving. That means that the people who know the most about education don't get to offer their, we have to listen to the likes of Bill Gates, who knows less than the person who sweeps the leaves out in your garden about education.
And it's
a dire situation.
And in some respects, I mean, that is why you need to have. I mean, one of the biggest complaints we hear about teachers' unions is that it makes it so hard to fire teachers. But in some respects, that's one of the main reasons why you need to have that type of firewall, because to a large extent, there's a lot more. The agenda of the administration of a school and the way that their performance is measured is contrary to the way that teachers want to go about performing their jobs.
Well, yeah, that's part of it, yes. I mean, I think the notion that the unions make it hard to fire bad teachers is problematic for other reasons, too.
Right.
First of all, tenure doesn't guarantee bad teachers a job for life. It just guarantees them due process, so they can't be fired arbitrarily because they rock the boat or because the principal doesn't like them. You can still fire people even if they're tenured. And secondly, the whole debate has been shaped by the anti-union people in terms of the problem being caused mostly by bad teachers. Of course they're bad teachers. They're bad lifeguards, bad radio talk show hosts, and so on. But there's no evidence that that's the primary driving force for why there's a problem. And indeed, the nature of the problem is often misstated. You'd be surprised how many really thoughtful and, again, often progressive people simply repeat uncritically what they've read in the newspaper about how the U.S. doesn't do well educationally compared to other countries, which is mostly fiction.
Well, let me ask you about that, and I know you've got to go, but let me just ask you just lastly, like, how do we know that there is a problem? I mean, how do we know that there is a problem? I mean, how
we know there's a problem? It's not just whether there is a problem. The question is, what is the nature of the problem? The nature of the problem is not low test scores. The nature of the problem is not an insufficient number of graduates with mathematical and science expertise. We have three times more adequate graduates than we have jobs for them. That's not an education problem. The nature of the problem is kids who don't read because they've learned that reading is about decoding texts and acquire practicing skills by rote so they'll do well on a test. The nature of the problem is that kids are memorizing stuff and losing interest in the whole idea of learning and not thinking deeply because they haven't been invited to do so. The nature of the problem is kids who grow up thinking everybody else is someone to be beaten because schooling emphasizes competition rather than collaboration, which, by the way, is reflected in international rankings on test scores at yet another level. If you identify the problem in terms of the depth of thinking, of understanding of ideas, and the desire to keep learning, then you say, yeah, we do have a problem. But what's being proposed not only fails to solve it, it actually makes it worse by making schools more traditional and barren of real thinking or input in designing the curriculum by the kids, or these days, even the teachers. And finally, when you look at those international scores, you got to keep this in mind. It's not that the U.S. does poorly. Talking about American education is like talking about the quality of American air. It depends where you're standing. The rich areas of this country do very, very well in comparison with people in any other part of the globe, assuming you want to use test scores as your criteria. The reason we have problems on those rankings is mostly because the U.S. has more poor children than almost any other industrialized country. And in the poor areas, the kids are in desperate trouble. And that takes us back to where we began our conversation. The issues of inequities, of a gap, cannot be defined in terms of a gap of test scores, because when you try to correct that by pushing up the test scores in the inner cities, you make their education worse, because the tests measure what matters least.
Well, Alfie Cohn, thank you so much for joining me. All right, folks, that is Alfie Cohn. We've got to get him back on the program. That was from 2011. I mean, many of the issues are exactly the same, frankly. And the conversation is still basically where it was in 2011, as far as I can tell. But it is Alfie Cohn. We got a link. It's alfiecohn.org. We've got a link at majority.fm. It was back in 2011, I guess. Interviews were a little shorter back then. And my daughter was 5 and a half. Nuts. Time flies. All right, folks. We're going to head into the I should say, on Friday, I sat in for Tom Hartman on the Tom Hartman radio program. And so we are going to release that material as a members only podcast. I guess how long is it, Matt? I mean, 3 hours of radio translates into close to 90, maybe 110 minutes, I guess. 110 minutes. You're just looking at me like you have no idea.
Not sure. I'm assuming you're right.
All right. Well,
you're the one in this office who worked in actual radio.
Now you're gonna cut out the ads, right? Obviously.
I don't know, Michael. Are you?
I was thinking you would just throw it up as is.
Yeah. No. I think we should cut out the ads. We don't need the 6 minute breaks.
Okay.
That may take you almost 20 minutes.
No, it definitely took significantly longer last time, but we'll get it up at some point.
Well, I know, but this time, theoretically, you have more experience.
It's not a question of experience, it's just a question of time.
Yeah, I'm saying, but with experience, you get...
Then, like, magically, the computer moves faster?
No, it's not the computer, it's the operator.
Well, we'll have to just agree to disagree.
Oh, God. I'm not sure who's going to be on the program tomorrow. Wednesday, we'll have Mark Mazzetti on the story of the CIA essentially spying on the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee, because the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee wanted to see what the CIA really knew about their torture program. And, of course, we still have yet to see the Senate report on torture because, well, I think probably because the CIA doesn't want us to. And in the funner half of the program, we will read the letter from jailed CIA operative Kirikou. And also go over Snowden. We don't have, you know, some days are funner than others. In the fun half, the number 646-257-3920. Folks, if you
want to... Yeah, we'll get some great calls. That's what's going to happen today.
Yeah, we'll get some fun calls. Where I wonder if there'll be a renewed vigor from libertarian callers. We haven't had one in a long time.
Oh, Bush and Chan said it in response to our Bitcoin hate. He is going to put on a clinic today.
All right.
But I told him that requires, you know, calling in. You can't really put a clinic via instant message. What are you going to do? Own us via some sort of, oh, I got you good, but I'm reading that. I'm reading you saying you got me
right.
good?
Yeah,
come on now.
You're stupid. Max Kaiserlink. Call in.
646-257-3920. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today for just pennies a day. I mean, 33 pennies, but and I don't know anybody walking around with 33 pennies, but nickels a day, dimes a day. Become a member today at majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, you got to be buying it from our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. You will notice no difference. You're helping the show. You're doing nothing. And you're helping the show. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Great coffee. And very reasonably priced. I mean, in New York now, to get like one of those fancy schmancy bags of coffee beans, it's going to cost you $14. All right, we got to take a break. Bush and Chains has already started. I can see it popping up now. We got to take a break. We'll be back with more 646-257-3920.
If you ask me, Bush and Chains never began because he's never called into the show.
The IM is Majority FM. You can IM us through the app. You can call us through the app. You can get the app at majorityapp.com. We'll be back in just a moment.